What we have found in this report is that this is a company that, you know, it isn't just about the independent businesses that are being put out, but it affects all of us.
Earlier this year, Chris Hayes, host of All In with Chris Hayes on MSNBC, interviewed Stacy Mitchell about the growing power of Amazon, which now captures nearly one in every $2 that Americans spend online. Stacy is co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and co-author of ILSR's eye-opening report, Amazon's Stranglehold. The interview took place before a live audience at the American Booksellers Association's Winter Institute in Minneapolis. What follows is a slightly edited recording of the event.
So the report is fascinating. So I want to play a little devil's advocate.
Yeah.
Opening part. And I should say that I'm someone who has, I think like a lot of people, with my worldview and politics, has conflicted feelings, right, about this entity. Particularly because it's something that's become so omnipresent in my life. And one of the things I think the report does a really good job of highlighting is that omnipresence. Mm-hmm. So let's just start with this sort of meta question, right? So, like, I'm a reporter, and sometimes I get reports from, about how fracking is fine, right? And it doesn't hurt wastewater. And then, like, you turn it over, and it's like, oh, it's from the, like, fracking association. They're kind of like, oh, okay, well, maybe, but... You know, I'm going to take this a little bit with a grain of salt. Like, there's an obvious interest here in the people that are doing this. Like, clearly, the folks in this room, independent booksellers and independent retailers, have an interest, right? They're in direct competition with Amazon. So what's the case over and above that interest, right? Why should I not view this report or the things that folks in this room would say about Amazon in the same way that I would view a fracker's view of safe drinking water?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think because, the Institute for Local Self-Reliance has been around for 40 years, and we have a really great track record of solid, well-done research that's backed up by fact. We are an independent organization, and I think the report itself makes that argument. I think you can read the report and what we presented and the information there and make that judgment call on your own. It is not, it is not a polemic in the sense of being, being driven by an argument. It is an exploration of something that has, a company that has really come along in a very stealth fashion. I mean, Amazon, in a sense, is something that we're all very familiar with and is omnipresent, but most people have spent very little time actually thinking about it. It's not physically present in a lot of our communities, and it sort of creeped into our world. And what we have found in this report is that this is a company that, it isn't just about the independent businesses that are being put out, but it affects all of us. It's undermining competition. It's making it harder for new products and new ideas to get into the market. It's undermining job quality. It's actually a significant protagonist in the story of rising inequality. It's part of the story of the regional concentration of wealth that has left a lot of parts of the heartland without the kind of economic backbone that they need and has produced a lot of the despair that I think we have seen in the last year. And it's beginning to gut the vitality of communities, the physical presence of the places that we live, the activity on our streets, the tax revenue that underpins that. And it's all been driven in part by public policy. So for all of these reasons, I think when you look at this case objectively, there's a lot to be concerned about there and a lot that we should be talking about and debating that I really don't see anywhere near the kind of debate and discussion. And admittedly, we come into this as an organization with a very strong view that economic democracy and local ownership is critical to the future of the country and is really important for a lot of reasons. So we do bring that to the table. But what we're trying to do here is to start a conversation. We really welcome the debate about what this company's doing.
So let's start on Amazon as a company and as an institution, the way it functions, because it's a deeply bizarre entity.
Yeah.
For the greater part of 20 years, they've posted, in most years, posted no profits, right? Once you net everything out. And yet they're massively successful. They have this approach that is essentially almost a kind of direct subsidy from shareholder to consumer, right? So So they are they essentially are fine with year after year after year not having high returns, right?
Mm-hmm.
If they are constantly expanding market share, right? So it's in some ways it's sort of classic monopolist behavior. You undercut your competitors so you can take over. But talk a little bit about how distinct they are and how quickly they're able to sort of move through a marketplace.
Well, Jeff Bezos has been transparent about that strategy from the beginning. He has said to investors, we're going to take cash flow and put it towards the long term. You know, we're going to basically lose money in one sector after another. And it's very the loss leading, you know, it's sort of loss leading on steroids. It's in these targeted areas. So it isn't across the board. And they have tons of cash running through them. And it's also, they do lose money, but they're also making enormous investments. And so, you know, they're economically powerful despite being sort of not exactly profitable. Investors recognize this, I think, this coming monopoly in a way that I think a lot of the population is missing. You know, there was a guy, he's a Silicon Valley venture capitalist who owns the Golden State Warriors, who gave a presentation about Amazon last year and said, Amazon is a $3 trillion monopoly hiding in plain sight. And he meant that as a tribute, not as an admonition. You know, this is a company that is on its way to basically controlling the infrastructure of the economy, such that they're going to be able to levy a tax on a lot of the commerce that happens, and that's going to make them an incredible amount of profit in the future. And the measure of investors being able to see that is that Amazon is now valued more than Walmart. In the last 5 years, Walmart generated $80 billion in profits. In the last 5 years, Amazon generated $1 billion in profits, right? These are investors betting on a future of monopoly-level profits. And the way that Bezos has gotten there, I mean, he really has this vision of embedding Amazon kind of invisibly in our lives and to create a scenario where we're so deeply in that ecosystem that we never shop around. You know, whether it's Prime, which is heavily subsidized, I mean, you don't pay the full, if you're a Prime member, you don't pay the full cost. There's a loss that's generated by that. Half of all households are now Prime members.
Say that again, because that was actually a statistic that jumped out at me. Like, sometimes I think, particularly in the America we find ourselves in, which is very balkanized, there's this question of, like, is my experience like other people's experience? And in my Brooklyn neighborhood, if I walk down my street and I walk past the front porches of the row houses on the little block that I live on any given day, there'll be Prime box outside those houses, mm-hmm. including my own. When you said half of all households, I was astounded.
Half of all households are members of Prime. Amazon loses a lot of money in order to attract people to that. And a growing number of them are installing Echo speakers in their house. So this is the voice-activated Amazon speaker system that is not only being used in people's homes, but is increasingly part of products. So your GE appliances, your Ford cars are going to be integrated with Alexa. So it is a voice-activated system that is always at your beck and call. It's also always tracking and gathering data about you. And the idea with both Prime and with Echo and Alexa is you get embedded in the system, and there are studies that show this, people don't actually shop around. Once they have that Prime membership, that's pretty much the only online shopping they do is on Prime. And this is, you know, this is the goal. This is the loss leading goal. And of course, as this audience knows very well, Amazon lost a lot of money in books and probably maybe continues to do so. In order to push competing retailers out, and as a big company, it can sustain that forever.
Right. So there's a sort of model, right, which is take sort of cross-subsidized internally, right, before mm-hmm. we use social policy. Cross-subsidized profits from areas where you're generating profit, sink into lawsuits. Use that to massively expand and sort of embed yourself in consumer behavior. So, you know, I have. When I was on the plane today, I have the Kindle app on my phone, and for someone that travels as much as I do and is, you know, constantly sort of taking notes, this is obviously a huge convenience. Don't give me dirty looks. I'm just talking to you. And the Kindle's a perfect example, right? So when they sold that, they were selling at an incredible discount, right? It was mm-hmm. they were losing like $300 or $400 per Kindle in the beginning.
Right.
They are doing the same thing with Prime, they're now doing the same thing with Alexa, and that produces an ability to kind of expand through markets and determine consumer behavior.
Right.
My question is, sort of, I guess there's a sort of what is to be done question about that. Part of that is the kind of path dependency of consumer behavior. You get embedded into one system and it just becomes super easy and convenient to keep using it. Right?
Yeah.
And so there's a question about like, this is producing a problem from a sort of political economy perspective. And it's driven by the sort of size of Amazon, but also now by sort of path dependency of consumer behavior. Is there anything to be done on the policy level on that second part?
You know, one of the things that I think is really maybe one of the most important findings in our report or arguments that we've made is that we tend to think of Amazon as a retailer. You know, we talk about Amazon's market share in retail, which is huge at this point. They're the biggest seller of books, toys, and by the later this year, consumer electronics, apparel. They're making big investments in groceries and so on. We tend to talk about Amazon in that way. But Amazon really is a company that's after controlling the underlying infrastructure of the economy. So the statistic that I think is more alarming in some respects than the Prime membership is the fact that 55% of all people looking to buy something online start at Amazon. They're not starting at a search engine. And that's up from 30% a few years ago. So it's just this huge growth trajectory. So Amazon now controls a platform that if you're a manufacturer, you're another retailer, and you want to have any traffic, you know, you can continue to hang your shingle out on the search engine on Google or wherever, and there's, you know, less and less traffic looking for you there. So they're becoming third-party sellers on Amazon's platform.
And that is one part of your report. You talk about how quickly that's growing.
That's grown enormously, and it doesn't end there. Amazon controls a third of the world's cloud computing infrastructure, and they're making massive investments in shipping. So they now have, they're running cargo straight from China. They have 4,000 truck trailers that they're doing their own delivery, pilots, planes, the whole bit.
All of which they used to contract, but they are now bringing in-house and vertically.
Exactly. They're going after UPS, and they're going after the Postal Service. And so in all of these ways, whether it's the online platform, whether it's the shipping, whether it's the cloud services that companies perform, essentially what you have is Amazon taking control of the underlying infrastructure and then being able to levy a toll on every this infrastructure.
It's like a Bezos henchman in the back.
Exactly. These lights are connected to the cloud. It's all run by AWS.
Alexa, put the lights back on. See, that's why they're women.
So what you have is something that we encountered before in history, which was, you know, the railroad barons.
Yeah.
Back in the day, they gained control of the railroads, Cornelius Vanderbilt and J.P. Morgan, all these guys. And they use that control to undermine and squeeze small businesses and farmers across this country. And that's what gave rise to the antitrust movement. And we've lost touch with that. We've got to bring it back. Because, you know, consumers stand to lose here in a big way over time, even though it feels so sort of delicious and easy to be in the Amazon ecosystem. There's a lot at stake, and there's a lot that we're losing now that we don't even really see. But then the other aspect of it is, you know, we're so in this consumer mindset that we forget that we need so much more from the economy. You know, we're people who need to earn a living. We belong to a democracy, at least, you know, so far. We live in communities. We have all of these other needs that go beyond simply us as consumers. And when you look at what consolidation and Amazon's power is doing to our prospects of being able to make a decent living or having a healthy community and all these other things, those are real concerns. And it used to be that antitrust law was really designed to address those things in a way that isn't now. So that ultimately, I think, is where we need to get to. And you know, we lay out a few different ideas about the direction that that needs to take.
To me, the most profound idea here is this idea of it's not a competitor in a market. It's essentially an owner of the fundamental mechanisms by which a market functions, right? So those are different things. So as opposed to saying I sell 70% of the toothbrushes, I control the means by which every toothbrush is shipped, produced, sold by third-party sellers. Like, what regulatory interventions that are there available there, particularly as they move in this really, again, sort of fascinating vertically integrated direction?
Mm-hmm. One way that we approached this with the railroads was the creation of the idea of common carriers, you know, which we apply in communications and in transportation, where we say, you know, it, you have to offer all comers equal terms if they want to use the rail lines, telephone lines, or whatever. There's an idea out there that we should apply that to Amazon and to other major online platforms, that they are the they should be the common carriers and the sort of public utilities that are regulated and required to create a fair space for competition to happen. But in order to get to that point, we have to do something first, which is we have to cleave off Amazon's own internal operation from its role as a platform. Part of its power and part of its way of being able to squeeze manufacturers and retailers that depend on it for these services is that it's not only their major supplier and has all that power, but it competes with them directly. And its ability to sort of toggle between those two roles is something that it's able to use, you know, in a way that magnifies its power in both. So we have to separate Amazon, and I think we also need to look at whether or not we want to have a retailer that's also a manufacturer. You know, Amazon not only is a publisher, but they're making a lot of apparel, they're making a growing number of the things that they sell, and they preference those products. So you as a shopper, you know, if you're looking at the sort of carousel of things at the bottom, customers who bought this also bought whatever. If it's an area where Amazon has its own private label goods, they're preferencing their stuff there over manufacturers. So it's not driven by consumer ratings or any other kind of unbiased algorithm. It's driven by their own interest. So
that seems pretty open to antitrust enforcement even under the current regulatory regime.
You would think. Yeah. You would think. But all of these things, I mean, the common carrier issue is also, I mean, the idea of having a platform, you know, where you're competing directly, you know, you are the gatekeeper for so much of commerce is also on its face very disturbing in terms of maintaining competition.
You know, a lot of this reminds me of a lot of the fights that we've had over Walmart. And it's different in certain ways because the sort of nature of their digital infrastructure, I think, is sort of more profound than Walmart's. But, you know, Walmart essentially structured the entirety of American retail supply chains. They produced a lot of the same kind of negative effects for independent businesses. You know, I've covered this a lot as a journalist about, you know, what they did to wages, what they did to prices, the same kind of, you know, using the sort of scale to, like, just annihilate competitors because they can just undercut everyone on price, and before you know it, there's nothing but Walmart left. But there's also a lot of ways in which people would talk about government policy essentially facilitating or even subsidizing Walmart, right? So, you know, one of the classic things they would look at is, you know, zoning variances that are granted to build these big box stores, sometimes very explicit, essentially, tax subsidies and tax rebates that are basically government bribes to bring them into an area, government benefits that their workers end up claiming because they're not making a living wage, etc. Is there a corollary in terms of what you view as a sort of policy environment that produces or facilitates them?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's an extension of all of those things. You know, and you know, one of the things we found in the report, we went back and looked at the last 10 years, all of the warehouses that Amazon has built. It's built, I think, 77 large warehouses in this country in the last 10 years.
Have you guys ever seen videos of these warehouses?
Yeah.
Bananas. Totally.
Crazy. And the working conditions are as atrocious as you can imagine. Yeah, they got subsidies for 52% of those warehouses, one out of every two. We found over $600 million in subsidies in the last 10 years going from local governments, local and state governments to Amazon. And often places that are, you know, sort of desperate for jobs because Walmart or manufacturers that have been driven overseas by Walmart or what have you has already upended the economy and people are really, you know, anything that seems like jobs. So we're subsidizing bad jobs, but what we also found is, you know, in the process we're eliminating more jobs at existing retailers. So there are the subsidies, the sales tax advantage, you know, which is gone away in a lot of states at this point, thanks to the advocacy of independent booksellers and others. But that played a huge role in Amazon's growth.
Right, so that was a big fight for a while, right? They were essentially
and still is in some places. Yeah. I mean, they, you know, there was a study that came out of Ohio State University a couple of years ago that found that in states where Amazon doesn't collect sales tax, it drives 10% of their sales right now, given all the, you know, market advantages that they already have above and beyond that. If you think back 10 years ago when they were a much smaller company, or 20 years ago, this was essential to their growth. It was a huge government handout. In the world of retailing, it's incredibly thin margined, and the idea of being able to get a 6-10% price advantage over your competitors, a huge gift that drove their growth. They've got a massive overseas tax haven problem, as a lot of big corporations do, which means that they're paying an effective tax rate that's 1/3 of what retailers typically pay in this country. And of course, the fact that we are not looking at any of these antitrust issues the way that we would have in an earlier generation is also, in a sense, a government handout to this company. So this is very much public policy driven.
How active are they in state houses on Capitol Hill as sort of political players?
They're very active in D.C. They have a very active lobbying force. It's sort of bigger than a lot of other tech companies and other big retailers. They've hired some fancy K Street type folks, and they're very active.
How have they managed? It's interesting because one of the sort of conceits of the report, which at first I thought I was skeptical of, but then ultimately was persuaded by, was their idea of their sort of omnipresence and invisibility. So an example of the opposite is Uber, right? So Uber is this like lightning rod, right? Like Uber's expanded massively. It's gotten into a series of incredibly bloody regulatory fights. But it's also a polarizing lightning rod. Like people write a lot about Uber. It was a huge story. It's basically a page 2 story today, how Uber and Lyft reacted to yesterday's actions in federal court over the executive order issued by the president. Like, why isn't Amazon as lightning rod-ish? Do you have a good answer to that? Like, how have they escaped the kind of, even more than Walmart, because Walmart really did become a lightning rod.
Yeah.
It really did become a polarizing force. Partly that was a sustained campaign by labor unions. But Amazon, it does seem to me, has managed to kind of escape that sort of level of public controversy.
I mean, I think some of it's the stealth. I really do think there's a stealth nature of it. Like, even though it seems very familiar to us, in so many ways, there's so little, like, for example, local media reporting on Amazon. So I live in Portland, Maine. Amazon's having a huge effect on our economy, but you wouldn't know it from reading the paper because they've never done a story on Amazon because they're reporting on businesses that are actually there. So there's this way it's sort of, quietly growing and having these impacts that it's just not sort of making it onto that kind of a radar. Some of it, I think, is a little bit cultural. I mean, I think it's sort of easy for city dwellers who lean blue, maybe, to look at Walmart as this sort of thing from rural areas that isn't something that they need to rely on because it's not near them. And I find, we do a lot of work on big box retailers and have for many years, and it's interesting to see our audience react to some of this because, there's a little bit of a, I don't quite want to look when it comes to Amazon. I'm too reliant on that. Yeah. And there's, maybe it's not the same. And there's a way in which the cultural gloss, like Amazon is urban and it's part of this sort of seeming like new economy thing from the West. It has all of these sort of trappings of being modern and innovative and all of these other things.
It's not like the Christian conservative Republican dynasty from Arkansas,
exactly,
which made for a much easier target for liberal America.
Right, but they didn't shop at. So
right, exactly.
What was the loss?
Yeah.
Right, what was the consequence?
There is also the fact that, and I say this as a huge admirer of the Washington Post, and frankly of the Washington Post specifically under Jeff Bezos, right? So I think that the Washington Post, since Bezos' acquisition, has been a first-rate paper. I think the last year they have been as good as they've ever been, and I think a lot of that has to do with the editor of the paper. But Amazon does also own one of the two most important newspapers in America.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I agree with you. I became a Washington Post subscriber this year, and I feel like they've been doing some really great reporting. They haven't been doing a lot of reporting on Amazon, though. We find, as we
it's going to be your go-to site for Amazon.
No, and it's just very notable, and especially when you're talking about something like really needing to get members of Congress looking at what is a very serious shift that's going on in the U.S. economy with all of these implications. And we really need to be having a discussion there about this at some, and about antitrust and all these other issues. So it is a little worrisome to me that there isn't some more coverage, because we've kind of looked and tracked, and you know, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, other national papers are doing more.
One of the things that's interesting to return to this sort of commentary idea, right? Because what I want to say is, so when you make the case for Amazon, right? Like, the case is the fact that, like, first of all, it's just a technical marvel, right? And what they've been able to do, and the infrastructure they've built is amazing. It works. It's sort of in the same way that whenever you used to dig into the, you know, you could talk about the Walmart supply chain, right, as this sort of race to the bottom. But like, the actual logistics of the Walmart supply chain is like the Sistine Chapel. It's incredibly brilliant and complex. And the fact that it works, and the fact that every store around the world always has every item stopped at all times, is an incredible achievement, right, in the sort of narrow sense. And Amazon strikes me the same way, right? Like, the breadth, the sort of platform, and the reason I think the common carrier idea is interesting, right, is because, like, there's some part of me that doesn't want to scrap that.
Right,
in the same way, like, you don't want to scrap the railroad. Like, the infrastructure that's been constructed, its scope, its power, its ease, all of those things seem to me essentially net positives. The question becomes about sort of political market power.
Absolutely. And I think that's a very good observation. I think one of the reasons we've missed Amazon, or have been slow to notice the kind of market power that it's amassed and the consequences, is we kind of imagine that the web is this place where, you know, any moment some other upstart company could come along and just disrupt everything. Because we've seen that. You know, we saw it with Facebook or Uber or all these different companies. But when you actually look, we actually haven't seen that in a while. And what we've seen is Amazon in particular going out, and whenever there's a company that competes and begins to make an inroad, whether it's diapers.com, whether it's Zappos, Amazon goes after them and loses a lot of money in order to squeeze them to the point that they end up selling. Those two companies are now, as you may know, owned by Amazon. So I think, you know, there's a way in which they have become like a fortress where there isn't going to be an ability for other companies necessarily to come up and compete. And a lot of it is driven by their data. So this is going to be the growing thing with our economy now. The more data and big data, big analytics that you can amass, it becomes very difficult for a new entrant to come along and challenge that. So it's the infrastructure of the shipping and the sort of supply chain that you talked about, but it's also the data and the ability to process all of that data. And just to say one more thing on your question, I think, you know, we have been, as a society, very interested for 40 years or 35 years now in what was possible in terms of centralized efficiency in economic models.
Totally.
Walmart being
totally.
A great example, Amazon being another. I would argue that we need to start recognizing that there's an enormous value to a diverse ecology. You know, some of the most powerful parts of sort of the reporting that we did for this report were the conversations that my co-author and I had with manufacturers. But it is alarming what they're seeing. And they all spoke to, when we interviewed sporting goods manufacturers and apparel makers and toy makers, and they all told the same story about how the independent brick and mortar retailers and that sort of diverse ecology of small businesses, you know, they're a small share of the market, but they're like this keystone species. They play this outsized role because they're the key thing to introducing people to new products. And one manufacturer after another said to us, we wouldn't be able to introduce a new product if it weren't for independent brick and mortar. If it's successful, that product will go on to be sold in mass merchandisers and so on.
That's a fascinating point.
You know, and in the book world, you know, the statistics are pretty shocking. You know, search works really well on Amazon. If you know exactly what you want to find, it's great. Browsing, not so much. You're three times more likely to discover a book that you'd like to read if you're in a physical bookstore than you are browsing on Amazon. And that's not just true of books, it's true of toys,
it's true of all these
other products, yeah.
You know, I've had the experience. It's funny you say that, right? Because that's another sort of flip side of consumer behavior. I've had the experience, I'm sure others have as well, where you're like up against the gun of like Christmas and Hanukkah shopping.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh, let me just buy some stuff. Like, I'm here, I have 20 minutes at my desk. It's like useless to try to browse, and not just Amazon, any website. It just like, it doesn't really work, right? So like, you end up going to these like third-party gift guides. It's like, did someone write up a thing about like what 62-year-old uncles like? Is there like a is there a guide for that? Like, because it really is like, there's something about the experience of it, and it's not just Amazon. I think it's broader, where like It just doesn't work to browse.
That's totally true. And I'm lucky to live in a city where I have a lot of independent retailers, and I know them well, and I can go into the local toy store in that, you know, that crunch time before the holidays and say, okay, I have a 4-year-old niece, I have a 2-year-old nephew, and I can walk out of there and have it be very convenient and quick because I'm dealing with people who have a ton of expertise and they know exactly what a 2-year-old boy wants right now, you know?
Right.
And that's actually, I find, enormously convenient, and, you know, a lot of things that people attribute to online retail, we can actually tap into this expertise that's out there. And I think, you know, just as I said, we've been enamored with this centralization and big efficiency and all these things as a society. We've completely lost track of all the value that goes with that much more dispersed ecology of an industry.
But to put on my, like, University of Chicago economist hat for a second, right?
Do you have one of those?
Yes, I do. I keep it in my back pocket. If we were at this conference 15 years ago, right, we would be talking about Barnes & Noble and Borders, right? And how they wrote.
We were talking about Amazon.
Well, Amazon as well, but also Barnes and Noble and Borders, right? I mean, I went to local meetings at my independent bookstore about them. I mean, I wrote articles about it. They were this both the, together, this sort of implacable behemoths. They were going to destroy independent booksellers. And what ended up happening was, this is me talking with my sort of, you know, classical economics, University of Chicago economist hat on, right? What happened was the creative destruction of the market. Like, you liberals, you were all panicked about these entities, and you said they were these big bag monsters, but the sort of divine logic of capitalism meant that they actually met the, like, fiery death of competition. And now you want to tell me that, well, it's the same thing with Amazon, but like some other great force is going to come along and destroy them because that's the way the market works.
Yeah, well, the story has continued. The story then was we're seeing a shocking amount of consolidation in the economy, not just in retail, of course, but across all of these different sectors. And that was true 15 years ago, and we look now to where we are, and things are only more consolidated. I mean, then we had two big book chains, we had Amazon sort of growing, we had independent, and now really we have Amazon. 70% of all books sold online, coming through Amazon, most books being sold online, enormous amount of market power. But this is, I think in some ways your question perhaps your point perhaps goes to this larger issue, which is, this isn't just, Amazon is an incredible, case study of what's happening, but this is a larger trend that's happening in one industry after another, and it has only gotten worse in the last 15 years. And the economic analysis that has come out about it, the connection between rising income inequality and growing consolidation is pretty stark. The connection between sort of declining civic involvement in consolidation is pretty stark. And when we look at what's happening in a lot of regions of the country where, they've lost having businesses and industries that are locally controlled, and, that sense of a loss of power and control over your future and sort of centralization of power on Wall Street and in a few big cities, and the growing gap between the haves and the have-nots, this is all being driven by this trend. So Amazon is really an extension of the Barnes & Noble and Borders fight, as opposed to, something that actually changed the dynamic. It just took it further in an even more destructive direction.
But it also does seem to me that when you think about who's at the point of the spear, right, in the competitive standpoint. So when I think about, we were having this conversation earlier, so let's forget about books for a second, right? Books are a very special good in certain ways, right, for a lot of reasons. And I don't have to make that case to people in this room. But that's not true of, like, paper towels, right? Like, I don't need a lot of expertise in who sells me paper towels or toothpaste or things like that. So when I think about my use as a consumer of Amazon, when I think about who's going to really take it on the chin, I have a independent local pharmacy in my neighborhood where I get my prescriptions filled because I know the pharmacist and I like them and they're great and I have that kind of relationship. I've also got a chain drugstore where it's very easy to pick up 100 different brands of toothpaste. They're the ones that are going to take it on the chin from Prime expansion, it seems to me. CVS, Duane Reade, ShopRite, as Amazon moves into groceries, that in the same way that Amazon took out Borders, I mean, quite directly, right? And you guys are still standing, although, you know, it's complicated. It seems to me like the CVS and the Duane Reade in my neighborhood is going to get knocked out first by the expansion of Prime rather than the Ballard Pharmacy that's around the block.
I mean, certainly Amazon's having a massive effect on chain retailers and their consequences for communities in terms of tax revenue as their stores go vacant and so forth. You know, we do a survey every year. We did a survey last year of about 3,000 independent businesses nationwide. About half of them are retailers. And when we ask them, you know, from a list, like, what are your biggest challenges? You know, a whole long list of things, you know, like can't find qualified employees, rising healthcare costs, you know, all these things you can think about that might affect a small business. You know, the clustered is a set of answers here that include any number of those challenges. And then way up here is Amazon. You know, competition.
By name. Amazon.
We said large, and we said large online retailers, which is Amazon. I honestly don't know why we hesitated to name names, but we did. We just put it more neutrally. But it's, you know, that's what it is. That's what they perceive as happening, and they're right. I mean, we've lost 108,000 independent retail stores in the last 15 years, a net decline of 108,000. We are at the lowest level of new small business formation in this country. We're at half the rate of new small business formation now that we were in the late 1970s. And we think we're living in this golden age of startups. We are not. And this is something that's very alarming to economists because it's those new businesses that are the job engine in terms of growth. And, you know, as you look at the evidence out there, so much of that is consolidation. You know, in the case of pharmacies, you know, just to, you know, add a dimension to this, most independent pharmacies don't make money on the toothpaste and stuff. They actually are in the business of prescriptions.
Right.
They're being squeezed by PBMs, pharmacy benefit management companies, one of which is CVS Health.
Right.
And there's two of them that control 80% of the market in this country, and they set the reimbursement terms and the contract terms in order to steer people and drive people to their own pharmacies and to undermine the independence. I mean, it's when you look at it, it's a gross example of how a big company is using its market power to undermine competition and to destroy local economies. And, you know, it's part of the social. We had, you know, I would argue, and I think on the left, you know, we remember the history of, like, what happened. We used to have this sort of narrowing of incomes and a rising middle class, you know, in the middle part of the 20th century. I mean, not everyone was included in that, of course, you know, to be clear about the history. When we look back at that sort of seemingly better and more equitable time, we remember the labor story, right? We remember growing unions, we remember rising wages and sort of the power of workers. And we often talk about what's happened in the last 35 years in terms of the loss of unions and the loss of the power that people had in the job and factories. We forget the other part of the story, you know? It used to be that American policy, we controlled power, one, by saying in big industries where scale makes sense, like manufacturing, we're going to support unionization. And we're going to make sure there's a countervailing power that workers have on the job so that that power isn't, you know, by the company, isn't consolidating the economy or keeping all of the wealth of the economy. But in industries where there's a lot of benefits to small scale, banking, retail, and there's no huge benefits to scale. In those areas, we're going to sharply enforce antitrust law, and we're going to make sure that we have a robust small business economy. So that as an American citizen, you have opportunities in which you get to have a say over your own livelihood, whether that's joining a union, whether that's starting a business. Both of those avenues are increasingly being cut off right now. And that's a big part of the story of what's happened to the economy in the last 35 years.
And there's really interesting, you know, there's very interesting rumblings around all that now. There's there's a great book called Cornered by Barry Lynn, which is, I would recommend anyone, because about the new monopoly economy. Opens with a great anecdote about, you remember when all the pet store recalls were happening because there was E. coli and other stuff in the pet food, and then it turned out that, like, all the different pet stores were recalling because they were all, there's like one, there's basically like one mammoth factory in China that makes everybody's pet food. And his one of his points in that book is the sort of consolidation, but also the sort of like lost tradition of antitrust enforcement, and there's Zephyr Teachout is writing about this, and there's like a lot of interesting stuff. Do you, you know, do you see momentum, political momentum for that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question right now.
Well, let me say this. It is also possible the Washington Post pisses off the President of the United States, and he brings the hammer down on Jeff Bezos. So, I mean, that's not really a joke. Like, that's entirely possible. But that's how we get Amazon antitrust.
Who knows? You know, I mean, through last year, it was really interesting. I mean, Elizabeth Warren gave this terrific speech in June. If you haven't actually gone and either listened or read the speech online, it's really worthwhile. It's the best antitrust speech that anyone's given in, I know, generations, at that level of government, has given in generations. Really strong, and she makes this beautiful case about, you know, from this perspective of us being people who need to earn a living in the economy, that this isn't just about consumer prices, though she also makes that case as well, and that this is very much political. You know, antitrust and concentrations of power aren't just about what these companies can do to the economy, but they're also the ways that they take over our democracy. So that was very encouraging. It's been very encouraging to see the kind of scholarship that's happened by economists in the last few years. There have been a lot of studies that have come out and said, there is something wrong. We're, you know, whether it's the loss of new entrepreneurs, new businesses getting started, whether it's the connection to inequality, a lot of economists pointing a finger at this kind of concentration. You have entities like the Wall Street Journal and the Economist magazine who are reporting on this in a way that, you know, is different. You know, it seems really pretty remarkable for those kinds of, you know, media institutions to be reporting on. So all of that's very encouraging. I think, you know, we're in this upside down moment that I don't know what is, you know, we don't know what's going to happen with anything. I will say that in terms of our research, one of the things we're looking at much more closely in the coming months is what is the power of the state level, because states also have fair trade laws. And we have state attorneys general, some of whom I think get this issue. And what can we begin to do there?
Yeah, there's also, when you mentioned this at the top about sort of, you know, one of the dominant stories that's a sort of political story and also an economic story is a sort of geographic polarization and geographic inequality, right? So we have this, like, incredible geospatial concentration of capital and then just wide swaths of the country that have very little, right? And it's obviously related, right? Because an economy that produces more smaller than sized firms, that can be anywhere, right? If you're running local retail, like, that could be in Mahoning County, Ohio. But other things can only end up getting centralized. And it seems to me, particularly given the election results and particularly given the way that that sort of maps on in this very intense way, when you look at large parts of the country where the story tends to still be about manufacturing, which is true, but there's another part of it too, other than manufacturing, right? Which is like, okay, manufacturing's not coming back. And there's a lot of reasons, I think, that the share of people that are working in manufacturing is going to either hold steady or decline. There's other things people can do in places that make places vibrant, but are also dependent on an economy and an ecosystem of small and mid-sized firms that can interact with each other at a local level.
Exactly, and it's, you know, it's, I think that, and there's been some good reporting done on this, I think, looking at, you know, what's happening to the wealth out there. But places like, you know, St. Louis or Michigan, where you had communities that had local banks, so they had capital flowing through and capital and decisions about what businesses were going to be financed that were happening locally, where you had you know, a sense of like pride and self-worth and control over your own destiny that goes with living in a community where you have the wherewithal to, you know, supply some of your own needs, to have some say over what happens to you. And that's, you know, we've seen these waves of, you know, of Walmart and, you know, driving sort of manufacturing away, Walmart coming in and undermining small businesses, Target and the other ones as well. And now we've got Amazon, and even the Walmart jobs may go by the wayside in the as Amazon grows. And so what is really left in places? And, you know, it seems to me that the potential for the divide to grow between coastal, relatively affluent folks who benefit from,
like, metropolitan areas of concentrated economic activity,
Yeah, and you know, to be able to, you know, to receive a convenience from Amazon, for example, you know, to be in a job where you're well paid, and a lot of the country not having really any opportunities or control left, and that scares me as a growing divide.
Throw it open to questions. Anyone have a question?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I don't know if you all heard it, but it's about, I'm sorry, you're supposed to be moderating.
No, go ahead.
You know, we're relying on you to some extent to share this with journalists in your community and with elected officials in your community. We're certainly trying to generate as much media attention as we can for the findings and to work with reporters and looking at some of the questions that we raise in the report. So that's happening. We're going to be putting out some shorter fact sheets that summarize some of these issues because we know that a 73-page report is not something that everyone's going to sit down and read. When we got into the issue, we really felt like we needed to take that much space to unpack a bunch of it, but we're going to be doing some shorter pieces on that. So that's what we're going to do, but you know, I think this is really a bigger conversation that everyone kind of needs to be involved in. And how do we generate more discussion about what the implications of this are?
All right, well, give a round of applause. Thank you very much.
That was Stacy Mitchell, director of the Community Scaled Economy Initiative and co-director at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, talking with journalist Chris Hayes. Stacy and Chris were discussing the report she co-authored with Olivia LaVecchia titled Amazon Stranglehold: How the Company's Tightening Grip is Stifling Competition, Eroding Jobs, and Threatening Communities. Download the report at ilsr.org/Amazon-Stranglehold. Thanks to Lobo Loco for the song Bears Conference, licensed through Creative Commons. And thanks for listening.